Welcome to the Maggie Williams Podcast, where we discuss hunting, travel, and outdoor adventures. Proudly sponsored by Rolling Thunder Game Calls, the sound of a new generation. Brought to you by Heavy Shot, industry leaders in shot shell ammunition innovation. I didn't come this far to miss. Lost Hat Company. Ask your other hat company what choke you should shoot. Get lost. And Ridgemark Retrievers, the trusted experts behind Kate's gun dog training. Find your mark.
What's going on, y'all, and welcome to another episode of the Maggie Williams Podcast. I am so excited for today's guest. I'd like to give a warm welcome to Dr. Mike Chamberlain.
Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us.
You are absolutely welcome.
So, Doc, you're better known as the Wild Turkey Doctor. Can you explain to everyone how you got that name?
Good question. So, I was... As crazy as it sounds, I was trying to create handles for social media, and I started going through, this was five-ish, 6 years ago when I decided to start posting on social media, and I was trying to figure out, okay, what would be a handle that would be kind of catchy, but not duplicative of something somebody else was doing.
Right.
So I started flipping through some other accounts, and I was like, well, you know, Wild Turkey, I think it obviously needs to be there. What about Doctor? And I was like, no, that's too long. What if I just cut it to Doc? And because a lot of people, particularly my students, call me Doc. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just do that. And then it was funny because a friend of mine has a similar account, and it's Game Bird Doc. James studies a bunch of other game birds other than turkeys. But anyway, so that's kind of how it started, and yeah, here we are.
Here we are. That's all I've actually ever heard you referred to. I'm a big turkey hunter and a big fan of Mossy Oak Gamekeepers podcast. You're on there all the time. But anytime we've referenced you in the podcast or your post, my circle of friends like, oh, hey, you see what Wild Turkey Doc posted today?
Yeah.
So it's taken off for sure, but... How long have you worked at UGA, and what do you do there?
So, I'm a professor of wildlife ecology and management. What that means is, well, it used to mean that I had two jobs, one job being I would conduct research, the other job being that I would teach. As time progressed, I made the request to get out of teaching. Not that I didn't enjoy it, but I felt like my real calling was research and service. So service being kind of outreach.
Right.
So now what I do is I'm primarily a researcher. I coordinate and run studies all over North America, doing applied field research on some critter, mostly wild turkeys, but I have other stuff that I still do. And then I get paid to do what I'm doing with you. Outreach type, you know, communication and trying to convey the relevance of research to people that may not understand exactly what I do and other people like me do. And more importantly, why should they care? Well, you know, why should you care that there's research being done, and what does it mean to you, and how does it improve your life? That's kind of what my job is now.
Very cool.
Been doing it for, this is my 31st year studying wild turkeys.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a long road.
So from the get-go, did you know that you wanted to study wild turkeys, or did you just know that, I mean, obviously, as an outdoorsman, what were you called to initially?
Honestly, I didn't know. I wanted to do wildlife, whatever that meant. And part of part of the reason for that was I didn't like people, right?
I understand.
So I gravitated to the outdoors because I was kind of a loner as a kid. I had about five or six really good friends, and that was it. I was never one of these, you know, one of these kids that had a thousand friends.
Right.
And so I spent a lot of time outside, and I spent a lot of time by myself. And the outdoors just resonated with me, whether it was sitting in a deer stand where I could think, you know, sitting in a duck blind or hunker down in the weeds or chasing squirrels or doing whatever it was. So when it was time to, quote unquote, make a living, I just wanted to do something outside, and I wanted to study animals, although I had no idea what that meant. And so when I went to Virginia Tech to get my undergraduate degree, about the beginning of my senior year, I realized if I could do something outside and be science related, not drive a tractor, although I love to drive a tractor, but if I could go to graduate school, I could make a little bit more money, because you don't get into my field to make money.
Right.
That's just the reality of it. So I went to graduate school. And when I got into graduate school, it clicked. I realized really quick. The first time I shot a rocket net over a turkey, that was it. I knew this is what I want to do with my life. And from there, I got some really fortunate breaks. I worked really hard, and things lined up for me. And now, you know, fast forward 30 years, and here I sit.
Well, what an amazing calling to devote your life to. Because like you said, people that truly devote their lives to researching wild turkeys, it's not for the money, it's not for the notoriety, it's for the bird. And so I think it's really, really cool that you've chosen this path in life. So thank you for that.
Yeah, for sure. It's enjoyable most days.
So I have been wondering this, and I'm very excited to sit down and ask you this. How are you able to take advantage of a turkey's gobble and determine how many turkeys are in an area without actually being there, like in terms of measuring gobbles, I guess, with whatever technology you have access to?
Yeah, so what we do is we use these things called autonomous recording units. They're song meters. It's basically like a trail camera that you put in a tree, and it has an external microphone, and it captures all sounds, every sound in the environment, and it downloads the sounds to just an SD card, like is in your trail camera. And then we pull the SD card, we run the data, which is terabytes of data. It's monster files.
I bet.
And we run that through a machine learning tool that we developed, my lab developed. And what it is, people may just immediately turn their brain off when I say this, a convolutional neural network. All that means is it's a tool that you train to do something. So we trained it to go into these data files and pick out every gobble, because gobbles are unique. On a sonogram, they look unique. The problem is that there are a lot of other sounds that sound like a turkey gobble to this network. In other words, it looks like a turkey
right.
gobble. Crow calls, gunshots, coyote howls, ironically the same things that make turkeys gobble. And it's because those sounds are in the same frequency band as a gobble.
Interesting.
So what we have to do is we have to train this tool to go through and become perfect, if you will, to where it never grabs something that's not a gobble.
Wow.
And so what we do is we deploy these things all over the place. We have them in states all over the United States, and we process the data, and then we can determine, you know, when does gobbling start? If it does peak, when does it peak? If it has multiple peaks, when are they? When does, you know, in many populations, we know when nesting starts too, because we're studying that. So we can relate the gobbling activity to the nesting activity, which helps agencies understand, you know, what's that relationship look like? Because all things being equal, we as turkey hunters want to hear birds gobble. That's what really drives our satisfaction, right? So we do that, and we're actually now, we're to your question about like trying to figure out how many birds are out there, we're working on some techniques now to take the gobbling data and use it to predict how many toms are in the population that we're sampling. To do that, we need to know the probability each morning that each bird's going to gobble, because some mornings they don't gobble.
Right.
And to do that, you really need to be able to know with certain, okay, that tom is right there on that roost and he did or did not gobble. So we're just doing this now. We've created a couple of prototype units, that GPS units that the birds wear on their back, and it has a microphone on it, and it will record when they're calling in the morning. So we can use Bluetooth to download that and real time say, okay, well, he gobbled six times between, you know, sunrise and the time he flew down, or whatever the case may be. So that's getting in the weeds a bit, but what we really want to try to do is, if we could figure out pre-season how many birds are in the male population, then we could inform agencies and even private landowners, okay, this is how many birds are on this wildlife management area, for instance. So if you want to design, you know, harvest strategies that make the most sense, well, here's how many birds you're working with, and then the agency can go from there.
Wow, that's fascinating. I've never been into learning science, but I have always been into learning about wild turkeys. So I think that's just fascinating data. Definitely above my pay grade. So I think it's cool that people like you can handle that and have a vision and know how to execute that and get that data. That's so cool.
Well, it's above my pay grade in some ways too. I don't do the actual, so I have people that work, I say this all the time, I don't have people that work for me. I have staff that work with me.
Right.
And I have some really talented young people who, for instance, are experts in machine learning or artificial intelligence. They're the ones that develop these tools that can go in and extract this information.
That is so, so, so interesting.
I just talked to people about it, right?
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
That's awesome, though. And I've been asking one of my really good turkey hunting partners. We've been debating on this question, so I'm excited to get to ask you. So I've been turkey hunting in South Florida.
Mm-hmm. I saw that.
We were hunting Osceolas south of 70, and we got on this topic in the woods. We went back and forth, and anyway, do you think Easterns will eventually overtake Osceolas until there are none left?
So this is going to be an unpopular answer, but there's a school of thought that Osceolas don't really exist as a subspecies.
Interesting.
And here's why. So there's been genetics work done on turkeys across their range. And what that genetics work clearly showed was that Merriam's, Rio's, Easterns, and Gould's all cluster separately. In other words, they're very distinct genetically from one another. But Easterns and Osceolas clustered together, suggesting clearly that genetically they're the same.
Oh, wow.
And if you think about it, and some people just went, oh, you know, I hate you, Mike, for saying that. But that's what the science suggests.
Okay.
And if you look at it, that should make sense, because there are barriers that isolate those four subspecies from each other. There are areas between where, say, Rio's and Merriam's occur, where there are no turkeys and there's no movement of turkeys.
Right.
There are areas that separate, like East Texas. There are areas where you don't have Rios or Easterns. You don't have turkeys at all between those two subspecies. But you don't have that in Florida. You have this continuous right?
Yes,
distribution of birds from the very south to the very north. And the other thing that is well known in the ecological world is called Gloger's rule. And what that is this notion, particularly with birds, but you see it in mammals as well, that as you get closer to the equator, they get darker.
Oh, wow.
And so, for instance, we published a paper recently on coyotes about this. You see a lot of melanistic or black coyotes in the southeast, particularly as you get down here where we are. But as you move farther north and into other parts of coyote range, you don't see melanistic coyotes. Well, if you look at wild turkeys and you kind of look at other birds that occur, say, across North America and then down into the tropics, there are clear trends where many of those birds get darker. Their plumage gets darker as you get closer to the equator.
Wow.
So there's this very distinct scientific recognition that, one, genetically, Osceolas and Easterns are the same bird, and two, if they are the same bird, they just conform to Gloger's rule. And as you get farther south, they get darker.
Wow.
Now, that being, I know that's blasphemy for some people. On the other hand, until they're not recognized as a subspecies, as far as I'm concerned, I go and hunt Florida. I wish I didn't get to go this year. Not yet, but I am going. And I hope I kill a bird, and if I do, that's an Osceola, as right. far as I'm concerned, because, you know, it's cool. And
yeah.
So I kind of ride the fence on this issue, but just throwing the science out there for you. Yeah.
That is fascinating. And I'm kind of floored that out of all the answers I thought you were going to give me, I didn't think it was that one. So scientifically, an Osceola is just a tropical Eastern with a little bit different characteristics just because of its region.
In many ways, yeah. Yeah. Now, morphologically, the other thing you see with Osceolas, particularly as you get way, way south in South Florida, they get, you know, their legs are longer looking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Their bodies are smaller, which is also an ecological rule that, you know, as you get farther south, your bodies get smaller. So they do have some morphological differences that do, I mean, you can look at them and see that doesn't look like an Eastern from, say, Iowa.
Right.
So before people want to lynch me, you know, all I'm saying is that there is quite a bit of evidence to suggest that at least genetically they're the same bird, which again makes complete sense to me because there's no barrier, right?
True.
So you've got gene flow operating across the landscape, which you don't have between some of the other subspecies because they're isolated from one another.
Wow. That is very, very just interesting information. I'm glad to have gotten your take on that. Awesome.
I told you I'd answer anything. Before we started taping, I said, just ask me whatever. It may not be popular, but I'll answer it to the best of my ability.
Yeah, I want your opinion and your truth. You know, not the popular status quo outlook on wild turkeys. Expert opinion from a true expert. But can you explain to our younger listeners why it is so remarkable that we have a wild turkey population that is huntable today? I think a lot of people my age, I'm 22, a lot of people my age and younger kind of take it for granted. And
sure.
It's just, hey, there's turkeys, let's go hunt them. And there's a huge perspective change in people that are my dad's age, you know, between my generation. Can you explain why?
Yeah, so if you look back, And I'm actually going about to start posting some of this content on social media about the folks that came before I did. And if you go back and read the writings and the activities of the folks that restored turkeys to the landscape, back, now we're talking people that were working on turkeys in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Those folks wrote about the fact that there were no turkeys.
Right.
and being able to hunt a turkey back in the 50s, for instance, was unheard of in many places. There were just no turkeys to hunt. And so you had people that dedicated their entire careers, literally, to doing nothing but trying to restore the wild turkey, going to these remnant areas where turkeys had persisted, catching those wild birds with rocket nets and other techniques, and moving them somewhere else and letting them go, literally in handfuls at a time. And those birds took hold. And then you fast forward to, you know, the 70s and 80s when populations were really starting to rebound and states were just starting to open turkey seasons in many cases. Yet there were still many states that had closed seasons. I can remember as a child, I was born in 1971. I'm 52 years old. And I can remember that there were states when I was a kid, these hunting digests you get where you can flip through and read the season frameworks for all the different, for different states. I can remember picking those up and reading about, wow, you can't even turkey hunt in this state. Mm-hmm. Like, or you can deer hunt in this state, but you can only kill one buck, no does, that right. type of thing. Because we were restoring a lot of these game species that had nearly been extirpated. And so now you fast forward to where we are now, and it seems like this is the way it's been forever, that we have turkeys that we can hunt, and that's just not the reality of where we've been. And I think people need to read about that. I think they need, younger hunters like you, I think need to be aware that there were people like Wayne Bailey and Lovett Williams and Henry Mosby and these people that did nothing but study this bird and worked their tails off to restore them all over the species range, because the science was saying, we can do this. We have the techniques to do it. We can trap. We can move these birds around. We can put these little radio packages on them. We can study their behavior, and we can do a better job at sustaining this bird. And so they spent their entire careers doing that. If it was not for their efforts, we would not have the turkeys that we have now. That's just the reality of it.
Right. And I wanted to ask you this as well. What is the likelihood of a bird that's in an egg, in a hen's nest, what is the likelihood of that bird reaching full adult maturity?
Okay, so we'll start with, you got the egg, it's in the nest. Across the South right now, we're seeing about 20% nest success, meaning about 80% of all nests fail.
Wow. Woo.
Okay. So let's say out of 100 nests, 80 of them are gone. You have 20 that are left. And let's just say each one of those nests hatches 10 birds, right? So we got a couple hundred birds we're working with. Now, about 65% of all of those poults that are standing there are going to die within the first month.
Oh my gosh.
So now we're down, we're well under 100. Let's say we're at 50 birds now. Well, you're going to lose a few more of those from those 100 nests. You're going to lose a few more of those birds during the remainder of the summer. You're going to lose a few during the fall. And then you're going to get to the first spring, right? When they're Jake's or they're Jenny's. Of those Jenny's, about 30% of them are going to die before they're adults, before they're 2 years old.
Wow.
And those Jake's are going, we don't see a lot of mortality in Jake's, actually, at least in the South, because there's not a lot of harvest of Jake's like there used to be. So if you just kind of look at the numbers there, we started off with 100 nests, and now we're literally down to a couple handfuls of juvenile hens that become adult hens, and we've got a few handfuls of Jakes. That's what comes out of 100 nests. So then what we also realize is that most toms that are shot when they're 2 years old, which I think most hunters understand.
Right.
God love a 2 year old, right?
Of course.
So then think about the probability that you are looking down the gun barrel at a 3 year old or a 4 year old or a 5 year old. That's when I was just talking about this the other day on a podcast, is that's when, to me, it really gets, not mind boggling. That's a too sexy of a term, but it really causes me pause when I kill a bird that I know with fair certainty. I mean, we won't go into the spur length debate, but I know with fair certainty that that's an older bird.
Right.
That's what really causes me pause, because I realize what it took to produce that one bird and what he's gone through to get to where I just took him. It is quite a marvel of nature. It really is.
A very humbling experience to get one in your hands. And, those statistics, I knew it was a very tiny percentage. I didn't know how small of a percentage it was. That kind of just proves the extra weight of that accomplishment it was to bring those birds back. A very fragile species anyway, and they did all the work and have got the populations in, 49 states today. It's truly remarkable.
It is remarkable. Yeah, I mean, it's considered one of the greatest conservation success stories in the world.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And on top of that, so we've talked about, the science behind wild turkeys, and I've got a few more questions about that. Actually, before I dive into turkey hunting questions, I do want to bring this up, and I know that my listeners are they're probably tired of hearing about this, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. I brought it up with Dave Owens a few weeks ago, but I'd like to bring it up to you, the mossy head turkey. I believe that I killed one in Alabama last year. I didn't know what it was when I killed it. A friend of mine was with me. I killed this turkey. It was maybe. It was a very long beard, huge spurs, tiny feet, tiny body. I picked up this turkey, and he felt like a chicken. Uh-huh. I mean, he was maybe 12 pounds. Just fascinating turkey. And can you kind of explain to our listeners what that is? I want to know what your I guess, perception of them is, and your opinion on the mossy head turkey.
Okay, so this will also be not popular, but
let's hear
I talked about this with the mossy head guys, and we had a really spirited, lighthearted debate on a podcast. It was a while ago. It was a couple of years ago, I think. Understand that, well, to my knowledge, there's no such thing as a mossy head turkey.
Okay.
What these birds, particularly the smaller birds that you see in some areas of the South, you need to understand that birds from South Florida were moved all over the southeastern United States.
Correct.
And if you look at the historical range maps for Osceolas, the historic range was believed to have originally been all the way up into the low country of South Carolina and all the way over to the Florida parishes of Louisiana.
Yes.
So naturally you would expect to encounter birds in southern parts of Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi, and that look kind of like an Osceola, right? They're smaller birds. Morphologically, they're not as big, which they shouldn't be, because they came from an area much farther south than many birds. The other thing, and so Dave Hawley and I got into a debate about this as well. The other thing you see is you just see variation in how birds look. You see variation in the amount of feathering on the back of their neck. You see all sorts of variability from one spot to another. You can have birds, you can genetically trace back to literally a handful of birds that were moved 30 or 40 years ago.
Right.
Those genetics are still persistent. And that's why you see some pockets where you may have really black spurs versus two counties over, they're super pale and, kind of pinkish color. That's why you see these little pockets. A buddy of mine, Chuck Sykes, hunts in Alabama a lot. They've got some areas where they get copper on the plumage.
Wow.
And it's persistent. It's been there for years and years and years, and you continue to see those plumage abnormalities. So that's my take on the mossy-headed turkey.
Well, I'm so interested to have heard that because – so I was going to ask you, if there are any myths about wild turkeys that you'd like to debunk or – so essentially, the mossy-headed wild turkey is simply an urban legend.
If you're asking Mike, yes.
Wow. Yes.
I know Toxie is – he hears it, he's going to be mad, and that's okay. Like I said, we've debated it before. There's a lot of misconceptions about turkeys, actually. There's all sorts of good ones.
Well, I am so happy to have your perspective on that because, I've been talking about it. I've been telling people about it, and to my belief, that's what it was. But it makes sense scientifically. Absolutely. There's definitely sound reason behind it. But I killed this bird last year in the Alabama Mountains with a really good friend of mine. And he said, "You know what's so special about this bird?" Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was like, it's tiny.
Right.
And he's like, "Oh, no. It's a mossy-head turkey." And we did a bunch of research on it. And we just thought we found a gem. And regardless, to me, every wild turkey is a gem. I'm not chasing spurs or the biggest bird or, the longest beard. It's really about chasing the bird,
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So it was just so fascinating that we thought we had an abnormality of nature. And, wild turkey expert says, maybe not.
And you did.
Of course, yeah.
It's like a friend of mine the other year. I go out west every year. I love to hunt in South Dakota. And because I just love the prairies and I think it's awesome. But he shot a bird the other year that was an eastern.
Really?
His plumage was he didn't look any different than any bird I've shot in the southeast ever.
Wow.
But there were easterns moved out there.
Huh.
And so, and you just see these natural variations in body characters and morphology and beard lengths and spur colors and feather colors. You see all of this variation across the landscape. But like I told my buddy, I was like, "Man, dude, for a South Dakota bird, you just shot a beauty. He looks just like a bird in Georgia." And he was right. And this guy lives in Georgia. And he was like, "Yeah, he does. He looks just like the birds at home." I was like, "Well, he could be."
Right.
Could be with the same bird, right?
Do you account that to turkeys being brought in? Do you think that has to do with it? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just see natural variation in plumage. You just see that in all the subspecies. You see some just look a little different than others.
Of course.
But yes, a lot of the admixing and the odd coloration in birds in some pockets, in some local areas out west, can be traced back to restoration when we were literally taking birds from wherever we could get them and putting them places, irrespective of whether that's where that subspecies lived or not. And Nebraska is a good example. Nebraska was a dumping ground in a lot of ways. Whatever bird can go there. Easterns, Rios, Merriams, whatever. Right. Just put them there. And that's largely why you see that most of the birds in, for instance, Nebraska are considered hybrids because they are.
Wow. And
they're kind of all admixed. And that's why you see a lot of plumage variation out there as well. So.
Wow. Interesting. It does make sense as well just to have variation because, as humans, none of us talk the same. We don't look the same. Some of us are bigger than the others. Some of us are tanner than others. We all have different traits. So it does make sense for some of them to be a little different.
They're all wild turkeys. That's the way I look at it.
Of course.
They're all beautiful and they're all special and we should be appreciative of interacting with them regardless of quote-unquote what subspecies they are.
So I wasn't actually planning on bringing this up, but now I'm dying to because I just thought about it. Let me see if I can get this to pull up and load. I had a message on Facebook a few days ago, and this guy sent me a picture of a turkey, and he said, "Hey, I've got a turkey on my farm." We're not turkey hunters. I know you love to turkey hunt. Mm-hmm. This is probably a rare bird. And he sent me this video, and he called it albino. It's not an albino turkey. I don't know what the scientific name for this turkey is. And it might be half farm turkey. I don't know. So that's why I'm asking you. Just.
Yeah. So that dude has got. That's an odd looking guy there. So basically for the listener, so she's showing me this video, and this bird has got almost really pale wing patches. So his primaries, so the ends of his wing feathers are basically white.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have any barring on them. The other thing that's weird about this bird is that his wattles, his caruncles, so you know, his head basically is super, super heavy, which looks more domestic. He almost looks like his caruncles are like they're twice the size of a wild bird. And he's got super, super long, lanky legs. If I had to hazard a guess, that's a bird that has domestic origin in it. But those wings, right?
Mm-hmm.
You do see that. You see wild toms that will have almost a complete absence of barring in their wing feathers.
Wow.
And you see that's the same thing you see with like smoke phase turkeys.
Okay.
You know, where you're lacking pigment. So the black isn't, you know, the browns are gone, if you will. So what that guy has going on, at least in those feathers, is just a lack of pigment.
Well, here's another photo he sent me of a bird on the property. And he kept referring to that one as well as albino.
So yeah, that's a domestic bird. That looks like a Narragansett, which is a domestic variety that's been crossed with a white domestic bird, because this bird in this picture has very little black on him at all, but he does have some. And that's one thing I see pictures a lot during the spring. People will see Narragansetts and other, you know, those domestic varieties that kind of look like a smoke phase bird.
Right.
But they're not. They're domestic birds. But interestingly enough, Narragansetts and Bourbon Reds, which is another domestic variety, those birds will become feral. So if you release them, it's not unheard of for them to integrate themselves into wild flocks.
Right.
And become wild.
Well, he told me he had a flock of Easterns on his farm and two birds with white characteristics. Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, what do you think? And I was like,
it could be. It very well could be that they've just become feral and they've quote unquote become wild. I was with a buddy of mine a few years ago. I think that was the COVID year, 2020. Yeah, it was. It was spring of 2020. He harvested a bourbon red that came up with two wild toms, and they knew this bourbon red was there, and they had trail camera pictures of him for 7 years. They knew he was there. He had been there.
7 years?
Mm-hmm. And finally, he walks up to us one morning, and gosh, that was early May. It was close to the end of the season here in Georgia. And I couldn't see the bird. I could see the two wild toms, but I couldn't see the bourbon red. And when my buddy Mike saw him, of course, he knew from the trail camera pictures that bird was around there somewhere. Mm-hmm. He shot him. And when we get over there to him, I'm like, what in the world is this thing? And he tells me the story, you know, this bird's been here forever. And I was like, man, that's a bourbon red that had become wild. And it was funny is his wingtips, he hadn't been strutting. He mm-hmm. was just kind of hanging out with those wild birds.
Wow.
Which I thought was interesting. Boy, what a beautiful bird.
I bet.
Oh, he was gorgeous.
That's fascinating. And growing up, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the area. I'm from Northeast Arkansas. I grew up on Crowley's Ridge.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so the only really range of hills in the Delta until you hit the Ozarks. Mm-hmm. And I'm from the most northeast part. And so there was not really a wild turkey population in my county at all. I mean, there was one known flock on the west side of the county in the hills, and there was rumors about these smoke-faced turkeys. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there is maybe 10 birds in this whole flock, but two or three of them had white characteristics. Mm-hmm. And I'd hear the boys at school talking about these smoke-faced turkeys. The likelihood of them just being tame birds that became feral, I mean, that's probably pretty high.
It's possible, but the smoke color phase is the most common color phase of turkeys that we have. It's not uncommon to have smoke birds in populations naturally.
Really?
Yeah. And that's, it's much more common to see hens than toms.
Correct.
And in some areas, I conducted research on a site back, gosh, that was in the early 2000s. It was very common to see smoke hens. I mean, we'd catch smoke hens every trapping season.
Really?
Yeah, and it was persistent in that population and had been for some time based on talking with the biologist and the area managers and everything in that part of Louisiana. They had been seeing smoke birds for years and years and years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is really,
they
really
are so
neat.
Pretty too. Gosh.
They're beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
They're beautiful. Wow. So one of my really good hunting partners, it's his life goal. He wants to smoke face birds. So I can't wait to call him after this podcast and be like, hey.
It could happen.
Doc says it's definitely possible.
Yeah. I want to shoot one too.
So as a Georgia boy, what is your favorite subspecies to hunt?
Well, I have two answers to that.
Okay.
If an Eastern is gobbling hard, there's nothing like it.
Agreed.
There is absolutely nothing like them getting in your grill and just rattling you to pieces. That being said, so we're sitting here, the view behind my house is like therapy for me. I like to be able to see.
Mm-hmm.
And I get claustrophobic around here, right? Because it's dense, right?
Very.
I love to see. So I love to go out west. And so chasing birds out west where I can see where you're kind of crossing between a big game species and a turkey, even though, you know, and many consider turkeys to be big game. But what I'm saying is you can scout, you can see the birds. It's often a foot race. You know, those birds can move, particularly, you know, out in some of the places I hunt routinely. You can put some miles on your boots trying to get around birds and get in front of birds. That, I just love that. I love that. So I would say around here is great, particularly when they're just, you know, when they're screaming their heads off.
Right.
But if you said you can only do one, I would go somewhere out west. And I'll tell you, if you ever, anybody ever gets a chance to hunt goulds, that was the marquee, in my opinion.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
And it wasn't because they were gobbling more. It wasn't because they were strutting more. It was because they live in some of the most breathtaking places you can imagine.
I believe that.
Really rugged, beautiful, dry places, mountains. And when they get to you, they're so stunning. The white is so bright, and the base of their tail, the feathers along the base of their tail, look like a woman's eyelashes.
Really?
Painted white. And they sparkle in the sun to the point where I actually videoed this. As soon as you kill the bird, I mean, you can still see the eyelashes, you know, the wind moves the eyelashes constantly. And that makes complete sense to me, because if you're living in an area where the wind blows a lot, your plumage should help signify, you know, how sexy you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
How fit you are to hens. And just having those birds 20 yards from you, their tails are huge, their bodies are huge, and they're so stunning that... That was a hard one to beat.
I bet.
It really was. I'd go back every year if I could afford it, and two, if I had time, because that is just, that's a special one.
That's awesome. Very cool. Very cool. So I guess, I don't know if this will directly relate to that previous question, but so would that be your favorite state to hunt in? I mean, did you kill them in Nevada, or did you go to Mexico?
I went to Mexico.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I went to Mexico. Yeah, so... My favorite state to hunt in, I honestly don't have one.
Okay.
I do go to some states every year because I just enjoy those places, and I enjoy, you know, I've gotten to be friends with people that I enjoy spending time with. So you know, the turkey hunting is great, but it's also just being there with the people I'm there with. I don't really have a favorite state. Everywhere I've ever hunted turkeys, I thought it was a riot.
Of course.
You know?
Yes, sir.
And I try to, every different place I visit, I pay attention to, you know, the environment and where the bird's living and where they're thriving and what it looks like. And I take lots of pictures with my phone, and then I can go back and look and see, okay, that's what southeastern Minnesota looks like, or that's what northwestern Nebraska looks like, or whatever it is. And I can go back and appreciate the fact that this bird lives in so many different places in North America.
Fascinating.
That's the way I kind of look at it, that everywhere is unique. And so there, I don't have a favorite. They're all my favorites.
Of course.
Because there's turkeys living there, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I love that perspective too. And so I've had a lot of people kind of ask me this lately, and where I'm from, it's not a common practice. I don't really know the answer. I mean, I know the blanket answer, but I'd like to get, you know, a scientific opinion of how controlled burns help turkeys.
Okay, yeah. So in the Southeast in particular, in the kind of the pine-dominated landscapes like here where we're sitting, turkeys are inextricably linked to fire. They have to have it. And the reason is because prescribed fire stimulates the understory vegetation. It starts the process over, if you will. It reduces plant succession back to zero. And then what happens is these plants that have been burned put maximum nutrition out. They grow quickly. They're succulent. They attract insects. They put maximum nutrition in their stems, and therefore turkeys are benefiting from using the vegetation that's stimulated by the fire. The other thing that our research has clearly shown is that if the landscape is burned routinely, say on a consistent interval, so let's say every 3 years, you go back to these same stands and you burn them again, that turkeys are going to select to nest and brood in the earlier burns. In other words, stands that were burned this year, last year, 2 years ago.
Okay.
Once it gets to about year 3, 4, 5, that's not turkey habitat anymore.
Okay.
Will they use it? Yes, if they have to. But they're going to preferentially select areas that have been managed with fire.
Cool.
The other thing that we see very clearly is that some predators of turkeys are not benefited from fire. So I did work years and years ago clearly showing that raccoons avoided areas that were managed with fire.
Interesting. Cool.
And the other thing to kind of think about with fire is that, you know, turkeys evolved in the presence of fire, and turkeys make a living by being able to see, right?
Of course.
And so any management activity that keeps vegetation at their head height or below it, that benefits the bird.
Of course.
As soon as the vegetation starts getting denser than that, then you're giving predators the advantage, not the bird.
Right.
Yeah, that's the way I look at it with fire.
Well, and talking about predators, what are the biggest enemies of the wild turkey?
Yeah, so it really depends on the part of their life stage. So nest, gosh, there's a lot of things that eat nest. Bobcats, coyotes, foxes, raccoons, opossums, skunks, rat snakes, crows. There's a number of species that eat eggs. When you start talking about adults, the field narrows, if you will.
Right.
Bobcats, coyotes, and great horned owls, at least in this part of the world, are important predators of adults. Golden eagles take adults routinely as well. And obviously, man and woman, right?
Right.
I mean, we are the primary predator of males. Without question. I mean, human beings are the most efficient and effective predator that wild turkeys have seen. So there's a lot of things out there that are trying to eat turkeys from the time they're in the egg until they're adults.
Of course. How can, I guess, landowners, I'm not a landowner, I hunt a lot of public land. How can landowners, I guess, take efforts to eliminating these predators? Obviously trapping.
Yeah, so to back up, I'm an advocate for anything that can ensure sustainable populations of wild turkeys. I'm an advocate for the bird.
Mm-hmm.
Predator management can be an effective tool in your toolbox, but it's only one tool.
Okay.
The way I look at predator management is if you look at the research, for it to be effective, it needs to be intensive, meaning you take as many different predator species as you can. It needs to be extensive, meaning a bigger area is better than a smaller area, right? And it needs to be repeated. So you need to do it repeatedly over and over and over. So from a turkey's perspective, what would that look like? Well, that would mean as much acreage as possible that you could impact. That would mean taking not just targeting one predator like a raccoon or something, but targeting as many as you can legally, and then doing that year after year after year as close to the nesting season as you can.
Okay.
Which in the Deep South is, you know, me, I do a little bit of trapping on a property nearby here. Very little. If I take five raccoons a year, I'm doing something. And I'm okay with that because I know, is that making an impact? No, it's not. Those five raccoons don't equal five turkey nests that I saved.
Right.
But that being said, I enjoy trapping, and I encourage others, if you have any interest in trapping, give it a try.
Okay.
It's rewarding. It teaches you attention to detail. It puts you outside, which is never a bad thing, right?
Of course.
I would just say if you're interested, try it. And if you can find somebody that has any experience doing it, do that. Find somebody and learn from them, because without question, the most astute woods persons that I've ever interacted with were trappers.
Of course, yeah.
They just look at the world differently. They see things differently, and they pay attention to details. So, I would just say, you know, with predator management, just be realistic. If you've got a 50-acre piece of property and you take a handful of raccoons and a coyote or whatever at all, great. Enjoy doing that. Just be realistic as far as what you expect the outcome to be.
Okay.
It's not a zero net sum game. In other words, that one coyote didn't just save a turkey, right?
Right.
But go for it. Have fun. Enjoy it. And if you can target larger pieces of property, well then, and you pair your predator management with habitat work, then you're getting down the road of potentially having a better, you know, effect on turkey populations than just trying to trap in absence of anything else.
For sure. And you mentioned earlier how you were an advocate for the wild turkey, which I also consider myself to be. I think all turkey hunters should be. But I've been asked before, you know, how can you profess to love something so deeply that you also kill? And I am not eloquent enough to answer this question and do it justice. So I'm hoping you probably can.
That is the ultimate paradox. That is the way I look at it, that you cherish something so deeply, yet you take its life. And the way I look at it is, hunting is a visceral, emotional activity to begin with.
Of course.
And if I was not a turkey hunter, I would not be the scientist that I am. If I didn't if I didn't have the appreciation for the bird from a hunting perspective that I do, I would not have the abilities that I have as a researcher, because I would only be looking at the bird through one lens and not the lens of, I just took that bird's life. I think, and I've been asked this before, like, how can you say you love deer, for instance? And as you, I mean, you can see in my house, I love deer. Mm-hmm. How can you say that you're, you know, you're passionate about managing this animal, yet you kill it? And I simply say that is part of who I am. That is part of me emotionally. It's part of how I've gotten to be where I'm at now. And I wouldn't change it for anything. And it offers me a deep personal connection to the bird that resonates in my research, because I see the bird through two different lenses.
Right.
And I think that's really important. And I also think, as hunters, you know, as long as you conduct yourself professionally and you are an advocate for the animals you chase and that you consume, you should never apologize for that.
Totally agree.
You should always, you know, be an advocate for the birds or whatever animals you're chasing, and behave responsibly and conduct yourself accordingly. And if you do that, you should never have to apologize for the fact that you are a hunter.
Of course. And, you know, it's kind of a slippery slope, but for hunters that do not know, for new hunters, for people who don't turkey hunt but are looking to, can you explain, number one, how you can be an advocate for the wild turkey, and number two, I mean, how to conduct yourself in the woods from an expert's opinion?
I'll offer my perspective, predicated on the fact that I'm certainly not going to try to impose any of my moral thoughts on someone else. As long as a hunter is following the law, then he or she should be allowed to the freedom to conduct themselves as they see fit. But the way that I see it is, one, we need to not attack each other.
Of course, that's something that I've seen escalate in my lifetime.
For certain. And I can tell you that as a child growing up and as a teenager and a young adult, the idea that you would attack another person that did this was unheard of. It was unheard of.
Well, hunters have enough enemies as it is. It can't really be each other.
And, you know, a lot of, as social media exploded, you know, it's easy to get on a post and criticize someone because you don't agree with the method they used to take the bird, or you don't agree with the image that they took of the bird, whatever it is. It's easy to criticize when you're not sitting in front of somebody.
Right.
And unfortunately, what that's fostered is this idea that we can say anything we want. We can write anything we want. And we have immunity from any of the consequences of those actions. And that's a really dangerous place to be as a society, as an aside, in my opinion.
I agree.
You're not held accountable for anything.
Right.
So the way I try to conduct myself is, first and foremost, I'm always looking out for the best interest of the bird. And what that means in my eyes is I'm making the best shot that I can. I'm using the best equipment that I can afford. I'm preparing myself physically and mentally. If I'm lucky enough to take a bird, then I spend time appreciating the fact that I've done that. I take pictures and images that I think are respectful of the resource and what it took to produce that bird. I don't criticize other hunters. I don't criticize agencies. Yes, I have my opinions,
mm-hmm.
but I don't see any value in us undermining ourselves, because that's what we do, is we undermine ourselves. So I try to kind of look at spring and fall and whatever hunting season is at the end of the day, I want to convey the fact that I have a tremendous amount of respect for the animal that I'm chasing. And more importantly, I'm appreciative of the fact that I have that opportunity, because we may not always have that opportunity.
Amen. Absolutely.
And our own behaviors in some ways are going to dictate the future of our opportunity.
I absolutely agree. And I've seen that. I'm also an avid duck hunter, being from Arkansas.
Sure.
And I have seen the firsthand effects of behavioral issues in the public woods to regulations in the public woods.
Yes.
They extremely impose on opportunity. Mm-hmm. And
I think it would also help us too as hunters. You know, when I was growing up, one of the reasons that I wanted to hunt so badly was because it was a social event.
Of course.
It was, I could go to the hunting club with my dad, and I could cut up, and I could cuss, and I could eat food my mom wouldn't have wanted me to eat.
Absolutely.
Stay up too late at the camp and laugh and hear, you know, ugly language and, you know that type.
Right, yeah.
And it was social, and I was able to learn perspectives from different people. Mm-hmm. I listened to folks that were educated to the T. I listened to people that had no formal education, but they were really good at whatever they did. And I was willing to sit there and listen to their perspectives. And I didn't know enough as a kid to even judge people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you fast forward to where we are today, and I think we become siloed in the way we think. And we surround ourselves with people that think the same way.
That is true.
And we're doing ourselves a disservice if we're not willing to step outside of that silo sometimes. And what I mean, and here would be an example. Don't fight the opportunity to be in let's say to join someone for a hunt that you don't know, or you've heard about, but you don't know them yourself. Don't overlook the chance to walk up to somebody at a meeting and shake their hand and strike up a conversation. Don't silo yourself. Don't always try to be around someone that thinks and talks like you do, because part of that siloed approach is what creates the camps, that the division that we have in our own circles.
Of course.
I'm convinced of that, because we're not always willing to be in uncomfortable situations or to think outside the box. It's a lot easier not to, right?
Of course. Yeah, yes, sir.
And I do the same stuff all the time. I catch myself doing this all the time, that I keep thinking, okay, Mike, you're thinking the same way over and over here. You need to step back a little bit and think, try to think a little differently. Or, you know, I'll read something on social media or something, and I'm like, come on, give me a break. And then I'm like, wait a minute, hold on, back up, let's think a little bit. Where is that person coming from? You know, mm-hmm. what caused them to have that reaction that I superficially disagree with? And then if I've realized that if you put yourself in someone else's shoes, you can often get outside of your shell a little bit, because you realize that you are siloed in a lot of ways. It's just human nature. It's what we do.
Yeah. We're creatures of habit.
Sure. Sure.
But absolutely. Absolutely. And that really brings us around to my last question. Questions, if it's kind of tiered. How can the average person be a friend of the wild turkey, an advocate of the wild turkey? What can we do to help promote their population flourishing?
First and foremost is buy hunting licenses. Keep buying hunting licenses. Support your state agencies. If you have the opportunity to positively impact any piece of land, any acre, a single acre, anything, take the science, take what we know about the bird, And if you can't implement it, then talk to somebody else about it. Be a steward of what we know about the bird. Be a steward of the science. Be willing to educate yourself about the bird. And then talk to people about it. Because I would hazard a guess that there are a lot of turkey hunters, and I'm not casting any shade here, that have not sat down and read books about the biology of this bird from start to finish. Everything from this is the names of the structures on their head. This is why those colors exist. This is, you name it. This is the plumage we've talked about. This is why the subspecies look the way they are. This is where they naturally occur. This, become a steward of the bird, and what you'll realize is we know a lot about wild turkeys, but there's a lot of ways we could take what we already know and do a much better job at communicating it to the public. And if you learn more about the bird, it's like anything in life, right? The more you know, the more powerful you are.
Of course.
Right? So
yes, sir.
if you say, I'm a turkey hunter and I love this bird and it's a passion, then learn as much as you can about the bird. Learn about the people that came before you. Learn their stories. Learn why do turkeys use certain areas of the landscape? Why is that? What does turkey habitat look like? What's it supposed to look like? Not what does it look like in my back 40, but what is it supposed to look like elsewhere? Read, you know, educate yourself. And understand that if you're willing to take sound information and talk to other people about it, that becomes infectious.
Of course.
Right?
Absolutely.
Right? So if you talk to somebody about something they're already interested in and you know a lot about it and you can help communicate that to people, then at the end of the day, you become more powerful with what you can do, right?
Knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. That's right.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Awesome. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you very much for sitting down here with me today. I really appreciate your time, and it's always wonderful to sit down and talk to like-minded people, but not just like-minded people, but people who know a lot more than me. So that's my effort towards education today, and I hope my listeners learn something from you as well. I mean, you're an encyclopedia of turkey knowledge, and I appreciate you sharing that with us today.
Sure, sure. And if anybody, I mean, if you need resources about turkeys, or you're interested in learning more, you can. I mean, obviously, you know, you're aware. I do have social media accounts. I post a lot of information on. I have a website, wildturkeylab.com. You can go to that and find everything I've ever done with wild turkeys. Every podcast, every article, everything that I've ever done. And we're actually going to start, so NWTF is supporting that website with me, and so we're going to start posting some of this historical content as well, which is really cool.
That's incredible.
And I think they will enjoy seeing like some of what we've talked about. If you're a young turkey hunter, you may not know what went on 50 years ago and why you should care, because those people that restored the populations we have now warned us that if we don't behave correctly and we don't prioritize the bird, then we could go right back to where we were.
Right.
And I think it's important that all hunters, but particularly younger hunters, can see that history. And appreciate it.
It's very, very important history, and it's work that should not be taken for granted by any means. Cause, I mean, lots of people came together for one common cause, which is the wild turkey, and it took a lot of work to get us where we are today.
Yeah, and you know, before we go, that you saying that caused me to think about something that I've said before, and that is, you know, when we were restoring, I wasn't involved in it, but when others were restoring wild turkeys, think about how many different perspectives existed on how to do that, and what was, how much it, you know, what would it cost? what states would be involved. And imagine the complexity of trying to move turkeys all over North America, crossing state lines, dealing with politicians, dealing with all of the state infrastructure, all of that. And think about how complex that was and how many different personalities were involved. Yet they made it happen because they all, to your point, they all had a common goal. They just had different ways of looking at how to get there. That's the, in my opinion, that's the way turkey hunters need to think. We all have the same goal. We just have different perspectives on how to get there.
Absolutely.
So if we all appreciate the fact we all want the same thing, right?
Of course.
It's how do we get there? If we all kept in mind that, you know what, we're all looking at the, we're just looking at this equation differently, but that we want the equation to add up to the same number, right? The same outcome. I think if we did that, it would keep us grounded.
I totally agree. And just to kind of close for us, I think it's remarkable that the wild turkey is something that people are so passionate about, myself and yourself included, that it was a powerful enough common denominator to bring all those personalities together, mm-hmm. for them to achieve so much and have so many people involved. That says a lot about how incredible the bird itself is.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Speaks volumes.
It does.
Well, thank you so much for talking.
You're
welcome. And folks, if I'm going to link all of Dr. Chamberlain's information in the podcast description below, some educational resources, some of his work, his website, socials, so you can find more from him there. And thank you so much for taking the time with us.
You're welcome. Glad to do it.
All right, y'all. I'll see y'all soon.
You've been listening to the Maggie Williams Podcast. Join us each and every time right here where you catch your favorite podcast. And if you've missed an episode, well, it's a podcast. You can go back and catch up. We'll catch you next time right here.